Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We discuss wildlife today on the show, and we welcome back Ward Stone to answer your questions. The former wildlife pathologist for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, Ward Stone, an expert on the fauna you see in your backyard and throughout the region. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you can also go to our Vox Pop page on the website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can check in on Facebook. It's WAMC Radio. We have a Vox Pop post there. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org or even tweet. It's WAMC Vox Pop on Twitter. Nice to have you back, Ward Stone.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here.
And what's new?
Well, a lot of things. I'm getting ready to come storming back from these strokes that I had.
Yeah, well, you look pretty in fine fettle this afternoon.
I'm in a good mood to fight for the environment, that's for sure.
Good. Well, it's nice to have you here. The phone lines are already loaded. Anything on your agenda at this time, or shall we go right to the phones?
Smoking.
Smoking.
The reason why my son is at Syracuse University, where I went.
Yeah.
And he is working on the anti-smoking campaign at the university.
Oh, terrific.
The university, Ray, is moving to go apparently totally smoke-free.
Wow. Wow.
Which is pretty incredible if you compare it with back when I was there over 50 years ago.
Yeah, you could smoke.
When you had to look across the table at a seminar through clouds to see the person on the other side through the smoke. And the inside of windshields. Yeah. Let's say nothing about all the pathology that's passed by and what's been learned. So I'm...
That's out of left field. I'm glad you're interested in that. Let's go to the phones. Kerry in Plainfield. Kerry, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Mr. Stone, and that is, in New England, are snakes true hibernators?
Well, not really. But they do hibernate. They do spend their time in a den over the winter, which is in a place where it doesn't reach freezing degrees for any period of time. It's going to cause freezing of their tissues and the harm caused by such things as ice crystals forming in the cytoplasm.
Okay.
So they have to have a place where they can go that's away from freezing temperatures for any period of time.
Mm.
So they are hibernators from that point of view. Now, you use the term true hibernator, and I would say they are not a true hibernator in the sense that I learned it in college, which is where there's physiological adaptations, which if the temperature is dropping below freezing, they'll maintain enough metabolism, produced heat, to maintain the temperature at freezing or above.
Mm.
Well, it was January 29th, 3 years. I live in a high elevation in Western Mass, and I was taking my daily hike. And it was January 29th. I remember it was patchy snow. It was a mild winter that year. And, geez, I couldn't believe by a stream. There I looked, and it was about a 16, 18-inch garter snake that was very much alive, very energetic. And that was a surprise to me on that particular day, January 29th, to see a snake in the woods.
Well, I saw that happen with a few reptiles in my time as state pathologist. 41 years I was the pathologist for New York, and I saw the same thing happen. Warm period come along, there was snow out there. Some snakes came out, went writhing about, and also some ice belted and some turtles came out on another occasion. And a number of them did not make it back into a non-freezing place, and so they succumbed. But that does happen every once in a while. But for most people, I would say that that's a less than a lifetime observation, right?
Thanks, Kerry. You know, I remember a story in the news not too many years ago, maybe could be 10, 15 now for all I know, but somebody had an exotic snake in this area as a pet, and it had escaped. It was wintertime, and they found the snake, and it was frozen. And I remember, according to the news report, they warmed the snake back up with a hairdryer, with a blow dryer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Well, I remember something similar to that. I was involved in several cases where exotic snakes, big ones sometimes, 8-10 feet long, came out and were in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a little warmth in the road, and that's why the snake was there.
Ah, okay.
But fortunately, with big size mass that the snake had, a little heat here and there, and it was back ready to eat and go on living.
Okay.
But I've seen other ones that have had the same thing happen, be on the road or some other spot, and be very cold, freeze, and succumb.
All right, let's go to Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Hi. It's great to hear Board Stone. I've been a huge fan and follower for many years. Funny you should mention tobacco and nicotine. I would like to say that I heard on WAMC that today is the Great American Smokeout Day.
I believe the 39th annual, yes.
And I would like to say that I quit smoking on that day, maybe around 20 or so years ago.
Congratulations.
More.
That's great.
Thank you.
That is really wonderful. Otherwise, you might not be here today.
I know. Well, I did it. I did it. And everybody should know that if I did it, anybody can do it. But here's my question.
All right.
And it's about cigarettes and filters discarded on roadsides, on beaches, at lake shores, and the toxicity that comes from that kind of litter. Can you address that?
All right, Ward.
I've noticed that, and it's very disturbing to me. You imagine here on the top of a peak in the Catskills and Adirondacks, or Adirondack Peak, and there's all these little butts down there. Somebody climbed that mountain, sat there, laid there, perhaps, and was propped up on their hand and taking a little bit of cigarette smoke in every now and then. And you would think about that person, I mean, how much they were losing by not being able to concentrate on the view and on nature by itself without the aid of a cigarette. And also, you think about the person who is inhaling it. If they don't die from cancer, they certainly are going to be hurting their lungs.
Yeah.
And they won't be able to climb the hill in the future.
Well, at least they got a good view.
Could.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Thanks, Harriet. Let's go over to Gary in Schenectady. Gary, you're on.
Thanks, Ray and Ward. Thank you for taking my call. Ward, like the last caller, I have followed your career for all of it. I'm old enough to remember all of it, and I thank you for protecting the environment and all the interesting things you've given us over the many years of that career. Thank you, thank you. My question is this. Just a couple weeks ago on a local radio station, there was a report of a property owner, and I believe he was out with a couple of law enforcement officers, who allegedly saw a mountain lion. This was northern Washington County, saw a mountain lion briefly, and reported such on the radio. I know in looking at the records, there have been a good many sightings and reports of that throughout the Appalachians, but particularly Adirondacks, going well back into the 90s. Indeed, one person I know well, and whose sight I trust, and should know what a mountain lion looks like, had a brief look at one once, as of other people. Ward, do you think there's any chance that anywhere in the Appalachians, and particularly Adirondacks, there is perhaps a very small but resident population of mountain lions that have indeed survived and been here all this time, considering they're very elusive cats, have a big range, and don't need to meet each other very often to keep the population going? What do you think?
I think there hasn't been a steady population of mountain lions in the Appalachians or Adirondacks or anywhere in New York State or close to it.
Is there any population, though?
Well, the chances are much better now because there has been a comeback in the West with the protection on the mountain lions that have occurred and changes in their habitat. Their population has expanded in many Western states. And we know that they're capable of moving, as one did, from the Dakotas to Connecticut, where it got run over by a car. And
how did they know it came from the Dakotas?
They had evidence on it, DNA, I think,
okay,
to start with out there in the Dakotas. And it was taken on pictures of it, too, by the CamWeb.
Okay.
You set out your cameras to see what kind of deer and so are in the area. And somebody caught it, I think, on that as well.
So there's been some controversy about sightings, and some experts say, well, that it can't be.
Well, we think that there's no continuous population of them that's been here since colonial times and stayed, and people thought that there was.
Is it likely there will be again?
You can't be absolute on that, but it isn't likely. One of the things that we went on was the fact that there were no road kills. But in Florida, where the Florida panther actually is a mountain lion, even with a tiny population that they had considerable road kills. Mountain lion is not real great for getting away from automobiles.
Yeah.
And so we had none. The mountain lions that I knew about when I was state pathologist was one got temporarily away in Saugerties, New York, and escaped from a cage that it was in. But I don't know about some of the others that might have escaped. So that would be a possibility, but that wouldn't be take the mountain lions back to, 1,400, 1,500 or so and straight on through time. They just were no evidence of that being the case.
So Gary's second question
was better now that there is a better chance of seeing mountain lions because they are on the move and there are more mountain lions on the continent right now than there were, say, 50 years ago.
Well, Gary's second question was about whether they could come back.
Yeah, so what do you think? Will there be a resident population then, Ward, at some point, do you think?
I would hope so, but I think that it's probably unlikely. One of the things we're going to have is pressure to save places like the Adirondacks because we're going to have pressure on them to cut down on their ability to maintain a species like a mountain lion.
Yeah. Let's take a break here, Ward. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Always fun when Ward Stone is with us, and he is with us until 3 o'clock. Get your calls in. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Flurry Lumber, Route 10 East Hampton, offering interior, eco-friendly paint, including Benjamin Moore Natura and Aura, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large. FlurryLumber.com. Edward Garbasik, certified financial planner serving all of Western Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. Ed at HavocandWealthStrategies.com. And Smith College Museum of Art, featuring the contemporary installation Tara Donovan, Moiré, Everyday Objects Transformed into Works of Art. smith.edu/artmuseum.
One 800 348 2551 is the number. Ward Stone is our guest, and we talk about the flora and the fauna and whatnot. Let's go to line 4, Mary in Amherst. Mary, you're on with Ward Stone.
Hi there. I just wondered what Mr. Stone's opinion is of your town of Happy Camp over there, which made news nationally recently because of its program of encouraging the people to feed the bears and come up close and take pictures.
I'm opposed to feeding bears, putting food out under almost any circumstance. But because once you get a tame bear, which you will get when you feed bears, from my point of view, you have a dead bear. You have a bear that's going to be shot by somebody in their backyard, killed by the police, or shot out of a tree by DEC and anesthetized because it's been a problem for a long period of time. It's been multiple problems with tameness with people. So I'm really against feeding bears. There would be a rare exception to that.
Well, this town apparently wants to attract tourists there to do this.
Yeah, well, that would not be the rare exception. I would have, the only time I recommended when I was pathologist feeding of a bear was a baby bear in the winter that had no mother with it and was starving. So while we were going to catch that bear, I recommend that the people wanted to put some food out. They put it out for the baby bear and then capture the bear and rehab it properly. But that was the only exception I had to it. So that would be really bad because it would tame the bears. The bears would wind up then doing things like swatting a person that came by a baby bear or something of that sort, put the bears in a lot of trouble. With people in the area when that happens. And so it's an absurd kind of an idea, I think, to recommend feeding bears in any town in New York.
Now, you mentioned a bear becoming tame, but how tame can a bear become?
Never tame enough that they're not dangerous. And I really love bears because I rehab bears.
Yeah.
And I raise bears up to the point I know what bears are like. And you as a father, well, I'll tell you, you get to almost thinking about your baby bears as if they were one of your kids because they react to you. That's why I when I was rehabbing the bears, I realized, hey, I am not this bear's mother functioning as a foster mother. I am this bear's, not the father, I am the mother.
Oh, you're acting as the mother. But when you start with a baby bear that has lost its mother and you feed that bear, isn't that bear automatically a tame bear? How do you send that bear into the wild?
Pretty hard to do.
Yeah.
That's why the bears, most of the baby bears that I came upon, that came to me, many of them had been for many weeks or months spent in captivity beforehand.
Mm.
But they, in general, did not go back to the wild. They went to captivity for all their life somewhere. And I'd try to find the place that would, you know, maintain them under the most natural conditions that you could, in other words, a many-acre pen.
Yeah.
And a good place to hibernate for the winter for their lifespan. But they didn't go back in the wild where they were going to wind up being shot.
Were you ever able to do, in your time as a pathologist, more or less a census, find out how many bears there are out here in the capital region?
Well, I think the census would vary in numbers depending on the month that you did it. And there are certain times when bears are on the move, so you're going to have young male bear coming out in the summertime, being pushed out by big male bears in the Catskills that have, you know, primary range there. And that pushes the young bear out. And that's why you see these young male bears being up trees and in Albany and Del Mar.
And there was one not too long ago in Albany, I think, within the last year.
There was. Yeah. There was.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Ward Stone is the guest. Lynn in Shelburne, Mass. Lynn, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This kind of relates to the snake person that called in. And I wonder what green frogs actually are supposed to do in the winter. But I saw one, I'm not sure if it was last winter or the winter before, hopping across the snow. There's a pond about 300 feet from me downhill, but it must have been frozen over. It was the middle of winter. I don't understand why that little guy would be out and where he goes.
Well, I can't really say about that particular frog, but my guess is it probably had a warm spell.
Huh.
And probably streams started flowing and they opened up some areas, and that opened up where this frog was trying to spend the winter.
Yeah.
And the frog got warmed up because this is one of the problems with climate change.
Yes.
That we have these kinds of weather changes that can cause the turtles, the snakes, the frogs to be out. And then you get this sudden change in the weather back to freezing again.
Yes.
And that then you have a dead frog and turtles and so on. And
where
I saw that happen.
Hibernate?
I became very concerned about that. Now we're beginning to see that is likely to be more and more of a problem as time passes with the climate changing that humans have made on this globe and continue to make. We're going to find that affecting everything from us to the green frog you saw hopping across the snow.
Thanks, Lynn.
And that's what I would guess. That you saw one that was hopping because where it tried to spend the winter, it was being disturbed by increasing running water in a stream and therefore got out and thought, hey, it's not so bad out here. This feels pretty warm in the sun.
Huh.
And you happen to see it running, hopping across the snow, which I have never seen that, and I've spent a lot of time out there looking.
All right.
But I'm glad you're extending my eyes.
Let's go to Ann in Coxsackie. Ann, you're on with Ward Stone.
Hello, Ward. This has been going on for about a month, and it's a grand mystery that the whole family is trying to solve. About a month ago, I took in all my houseplants, and they're very large, and they're currently in my bay window in my bedroom, and my grandson said, I created some kind of ecosystem there because this strange noise is coming from, I've identified the planter that it's in, the big chou-fleur, and it's a huge pot. It's about a two-foot pot. And at first, it sounded like a bird in my bedroom. And what happened was it sounded like baby birds chirping. And I immediately called my daughter. I said, I think there's a bird in here. And then investigation, they said, no, it must be outside. Well, it is coming from the planter. And I've narrowed it down listening to gray tree frogs, which I've had in the planter doors, or possibly an oak toad, which I know is native to North Carolina, but everything else fits about it. I cannot find it. I think it's under the roots somewhere. What is this noise?
Mystery.
It is. And until they
well,
kept saying,
I think
oh,
the gray tree frog is a good guess.
But
I don't really know
exactly
what it is. You're going to have to do more detective work and get a picture of it and email it in. And certainly I'll be very interested in what you've got there.
Yeah, or you could record the sound, Ann, if you have a recording. You have
recording? I have a recording. I recorded it, and I was far away. It's not as loud as it really is in person. Now, I'm going to try to record it tonight from very up close in the planter. I cannot see this. That's why I went to Oak Toad, because they do, the male is only 3/4 inch, and it could be hiding under those vines somewhere. But the sound is so loud, Ward, that it reverberates through the whole room. And until I had my family over for dinner, they were ready to commit me. They said, oh, it's outside. And they all, in the middle of having fajitas one night, I heard it, and I said, quick, everyone run to the bedroom. And they stood there, and they had been saying, oh, let's go up in the attic, let's look in the eaves. They stood there, and they all said, after 3 weeks in unison, that's in your room.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very loud. Could it be a cricket? Crickets doesn't sound like that, though.
It sounds like you may have got, like you thought, a gray tree frog inside. They can be really loud.
And yes, people, but it's a slight... go ahead.
And people, you know, hear them all their lives and never know what they are.
Now, is he going to hibernate?
Well, he won't need to if... And I'm not sure what that is. I want to hear your recording and see if you can see it. Where did you get those plants?
Whoa, I've had that one for years. I probably bought them at Lowe's. But that they've been like the chou-fleur at least 2 years. I'm thinking the oak. It sounds like the oak toad, though, Ward. And I know it's not in this area.
Well, let's try to find out. The reason why I was interested in where you got the plants was that there's certainly so many introductions and movement, even a range of animals.
Yeah.
And changing the range of the oak toad. And that could take place very well with plants that are being moved from one area to another for sale or otherwise.
Can you imitate the sound, Ann?
You know what? If you give me I could text the sound to you.
Oh, I wonder if you can email it to voxpop@wamc.org. We might be able to pull something off.
Let me write that down. Voxpop.
One word.
Okay.
@wamc.org. But I liked your imitation. You sounded like a chimp, to be honest with you. And I hope you don't have a chimp in your plant, because that would really be...
Well, as a widow and as a grandmother, I've told the children, well, if it's a little frog, I always love to get tadpoles and let them grow. And I said, well, if it's a little toad or a frog, I might just find it and kiss it, and then I'll have a permanent...
Oh, isn't that... And thanks a lot for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. That was really a good story, but an important one, because we have to be watching for exotics, too.
Yeah.
And you never know when you're coming across... an exotic. This might be the start of an interesting adventure.
All right, let's go to Joe in Ashfield, Mass. Joe, you're on.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Good.
Good. Hey, Ward, I got a little comment about the mountain lion sightings out here in this part of the state. And with the local rod and gun club here, we set up at the fairs with a display, and we get a lot of people stopping by asking questions, and you'd be amazed at the amount of people that have, you know, seen mountain lions, and they're positive that they've seen mountain lions. But, you know, I try to tell them, just like you said there, that, you know, they're a breeding population, you know, more than likely we don't have, but we may have a male passing through the area, like that one that got run over in Connecticut, you know, because their home range is a lot greater than the female's home range. And, you know, if we had that many mountain lions in the state, how come, with all the trail cameras out there right now, how come there isn't more pictures on people's trail cameras? You know, if we have that.
Because they're not out there, that's why.
Yeah, that's why I try to tell them. You know, and if they're so positive that they're seeing the mountain lions and sign of them, you know, yeah, they got to get a picture of them. They got to get some measurement of tracks. And there's a lady up in Vermont. Her name is Sue Morse, who does a wonderful talk on mountain lions and the possibility of them being here in the East. And she agrees that we might have them passing through, but we definitely don't have a breeding population here in this part of the state.
Right. Yeah. Well, I like your way of going about looking at this situation. You're open-minded and looking at the evidence. And when you look at the evidence, it's pretty hard to come by evidence that we've got any kind of a mountain lion population in Massachusetts or New York or Pennsylvania.
But if they're passing through, where are they going?
Well, it's in them to move to find an open territory. And so they would be able to go all the way to the Atlantic Ocean back in the old days, and they would run into some territory somewhere along the way and be able to occupy that, and there'd be deer and so on for them to eat, and no other mountain lion in the territory. Well, what do they run into now? They run into more houses and more roads and more bridges and so on along the way. And that one that started in the Dakotas wound up being right over in Connecticut.
Yeah. But, I mean, there is a lot of open space in the Adirondacks.
Not when you start looking at the size territory that a mountain lion takes. And with wolves, too.
Mm-hmm.
It takes quite a lot of open country to do that. So I would kind of like the idea that there's some mountain lions left in the Adirondacks and so on. I like that idea. But when I looked into it and I kept asking that question of myself and going in the field and looking at what was coming in, you realize that it is not very likely that mountain lions could maintain themselves in the Adirondacks period. And that's the way it is.
Okay, let's go over to Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim.
Yes, good afternoon. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
And it's great to hear Ward back on the radio. We had an encounter with a bear in our neighbor's driveway last year. We were having our house sighted, and two guys up on the end of the house on ladders by the driveway side of the house, one of them looked on and saw this big bear sitting on a neighbor's driveway. And, of course, he's being tracked in the neighborhood because one person down in the neighborhood personally puts out nothing but black oil sunflower seed to attract the bears. And then a neighbor two houses down from me came over after the bear ran up the backyard and ran away and said he was feeding bears. But I contacted our Massachusetts State black bear biologist, and she told me that people feeding bears this type of food in the summer months and all keeps them from getting their natural vital foods that would make them healthier and better able to make it through the next winter. They're not doing the bears a favor. In fact, she said, you ask Mass Audubon or anybody who knows about birds, feeding birds year-round is detrimental to their health as well. They're not getting, the natural vital foods they should be eating in the spring and summer months. And it's not making the offspring those birds raise in the summer months any better able to make it through the next winter either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree that we should not be feeding bears bird seed, and that in general we should keep away from that. And if you see a bear in your neighborhood and it's coming to your bird feeder, take your bird feeders down.
Yep.
And have your neighbors take their bird feeders down.
I'm
be careful about your garbage.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most unique cases I saw when I was pathologist was an Adirondack case where a big bear, it was over 400 pounds,
yeah,
came down, and a guy had some hound dogs, And each day he would go out and feed his dogs, and he'd put dog food, a big pot of dog food, by each hound dog. And the bear would come along and clean out the dog's food.
Yeah.
One right down the row.
Yeah.
So you talk about artificial feeding, but yeah. That bear thought nothing of going over and taking it from a full-size hound.
Hmm.
Yep.
So you want to stay away. You want to stay away from artificial feeding with black sunflower seeds, whatever. And there usually is enough natural food. However, the way we're treating the earth, what's happening out there, you wonder whether or not we're going to have plenty of natural foods out there in the future. And we better set our priorities at protecting habitat and species.
Right.
And we haven't been doing a good job of that. I mean, you take a look and you see the emerald beetle going in and attacking the ash tree.
Yeah.
You see the hemlock under attack by the woolly algaeid. And, you know, it's just one introduction after another that's knocking out species of plants. And you think about some of the ones that bears had to eat before, the American chestnut, almost on the verge of extinction, just still sprouting, still trying to be with us, but hardly any of them compared to what there were. And the beech has a blight, so the beech tree is down. So we better be concerned about taking care of what we've got native out there, so that we do have that ecology that this biologist is talking about, where we have the natural foods.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. We'll take a break here. Ward Stone is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Back with the home stretch next.
Support comes from Nature Logs, nature photography by Scott Stoner and Denise Hackard Stoner. Photo sales, note cards for the holidays, slide presentations, and workshops, bringing you the beauty of nature. NatureLogs.com. H. Houston Sun True Value Hardware Woodstock, locally owned since 1932, offering holiday decorations and gifts for kitchen, workshops, and home. Behind every project is a true value. HHoust.com. And Third Eye Associates Limited, holistic life planning, transition planning, and wealth management. Registered investment advisors, New York City, Washington, D.C., and the Hudson Valley. ThirdEyeAssociates.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ward Stone is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Having fun so far, Ward?
Having a lot of fun.
It's nice to have you here every month or so. It's nice.
Yeah, I'm ready every day.
Well, let's go to Russ in Waterford. Russ.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a question regarding white-tailed deer. I wanted to know, I believe this, but I've heard it from so many different people, that they are actually colorblind, whether that's true or not.
You know, I've been confused by that myself, and I've looked into it on several occasions. They certainly do not seem to have much color perception. That they don't see you dressed up in orange when you're hunting deer. You don't stand out to them. You stand out to people, and they don't have that kind of color perception.
That's been my argument. I wear red when I hunt. Several guys that I know wear camouflage. I would rather be safe than not.
Yeah.
And I've always felt that they didn't really distinguish between the camouflage my friends are wearing and the red coat that I'm wearing. So, and the other question I have, I don't know if you know this.
Well, camouflage counts with the turkeys, but it's not bad. I certainly go for the blaze orange, the red, when you're deer hunting.
Absolutely. And the other question I have is, I use doe urine that they sell commercially as a cover scent around my ground blind. But I actually wondered, does that stuff ever work as an attractant? Do you know? I mean, it's marketed as an attractant. I just use it as a cover scent.
Probably not so much an attractant as a cover. I've used it the same way myself as the cover.
Okay.
But you got to consider there's does walking around urinating in the woods a lot, and they would have some attractant ability along with the scent glands on their in their feet and legs.
Okay.
But right. I don't think so. I don't think that that you're getting that urine to be an attractant.
All right.
I never did either. But
you're
your
protecting
time.
A little bit with a deer-like odor while you're sitting in the tree stand or moving around, so you're getting less of your odor off into the wind.
Okay. Russ, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Karen in Albany. Karen.
Hi there. I have been, for the past couple of summers, in a kind of a war of nerves with some bees in my yard. And just a couple of big, fat, slow bees that like to hang around our deck. And a while ago, I noticed an accumulation of some gooey yellow stuff on the deck. And I took a look to see where it was coming from, and I realized that actually under our deck railing, there are some holes that have been drilled for some purpose that are not being used. There were empty holes facing down that looked to me like bees were stockpiling pollen in these holes where they immediately fell down and stuck to my deck. And I was wondering if that's normal bee behavior.
I wonder if you've got some carpenter wasps that are coming into your deck and making those holes. Did you apply any pesticides when you saw them?
No. And what is more, actually, these holes are obviously human holes. They're probably the railing on the deck was repurposed mm-hmm. from some previous thing, and these holes are nice, clean, round, drilled holes.
Well, some of the carpenter bees will make some pretty nice round holes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you the lengths I went to try to discourage these bees from putting the pollen in these holes because it was so hard to remove from my deck.
Well, you discouraged them in the end, huh?
I finally did. My husband kept telling me to leave them alone, and but I tried a couple of things. I tried, first of all, putting duct tape over the holes, and when I returned the next day, there would be a hole through the center of the duct tape.
Wow.
So then I decided I'll put several thicknesses of duct tape on the hole. And the next day I would come out and the duct tape would be lying down on the floor of my deck. And then I tried plugging it with various different stuff that would end up lying down on the deck the next day. And I did finally, I didn't admit this to my husband. I hope he's not listening.
Oh, boy.
I did finally use some wood filler and they went away. But I was kind of curious because
I like the way you did that. You avoided the pesticides.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The regular honeybee and a lot of our native bees, too, are in real trouble because of partly because of pesticides and diseases. So you were taking an environmentally sound way of looking at the problem.
Well,
and
thank you.
That's
important. I was concerned because I thought these appear to be bees to me. And I thought if the bees are in distress, maybe they're doing something funky here that they wouldn't normally do because they're stockpiling pollen that is just falling out of the hole immediately and sticking to my deck.
You saw some of the bees, right?
Oh, yes.
And they were big.
Big, slow ones.
Big,
not scary
ones.
At all.
Yeah. Take a look on the computer at the carpenter bees.
Oh, okay.
And see what you can see there. But it sounds like that's what you have. And they are really not, they look scary, but they seldom ever, anybody gets in a problem of being stung by them.
Yeah, no, I was just more thinking, is this, a hive in distress or something where bees are starting to indulge in wacky behavior?
I think they probably like that wood.
Ah.
If we're right that the bees are making these holes or And we haven't done that yet because you suggested the possibility that humans had been redoing the deck, had bored some holes in there.
Yeah.
I thought that's what it looked like to me, but that it was just a...
Well, you may be right about that. In that case, then we're blaming anything on the bee is not fair. But I kind of suspect it might be the carpenter bees.
Yeah.
And they will do that seasonally.
Karen, thanks a lot.
I'll look them up. Thanks.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ward Stone is our guest. Let's go to John in Poland, New York. John.
Good afternoon. In the last 2 weeks, I found two bats in my house. One in the basement, and my wife found one flying around the house yesterday. Now, we do have a wood stove in the basement. We fired that up about a week ago. I'm wondering, did we just wake them up, that they found a way into the basement and they're living down there, and we woke them up, or are they active this time of year?
Let's see, where are you located? You're located a little bit north of Utica?
Correct.
Okay, I've been through Poland. Nice country.
Yes.
Are you in an older house that's got an attic? And?
No, well, there's just a crawl attic. There's a full-length dormer on it, so it's a ranch with a full-length dormer on it, so...
Yeah, did you identify what bat it was? What species?
I did not. Not that familiar with them.
Okay.
Actually, well, the one that my wife found,
problems with bats, a little brown bat, and then there's a one that not infrequently is in houses and crawl spaces and attic crawl spaces and spends the winter there. And I suspect we had a very warm fall. We had high temperatures. I mean, I had flowers going well into November, bean flowers. So I've never had anything like that happen before. So, you know, things were growing very, very late. Well, what I'm saying is that for the bat, there probably it's warm. There was in some insects around it that could catch that didn't get pressed to take care of its wintering needs until recently.
Mm. Okay.
And that's probably what was happening at your house. That
so
the
I
bat is looking for a place. Yeah.
So they're probably living in the house?
Yeah. And they're not much of a threat.
Okay.
And you could probably find, I mean, likely place for them to come from above is through a light, around a light fixture, a little space around there. Of course, they do come down chimneys. But, you know, look for holes of that type and then patch those up, and that may prevent any more from coming down. But it doesn't sound like you got a problem, although there is a health department rule that if the bat is flying around while you're sleeping, the bat winds up dead and gets tested for rabies. And just to protect, you know, people from rabies, which is sound, which is their job.
Yeah.
But
sure.
But you don't want to have to kill those bats either. They are important. They are under a lot of pressure right now with the fungus, that white snout disease, and other pressures. I've been wondering, since I had these strokes, I've been watching the insect populations. I don't think there's anywhere near the insect populations around that there used to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. I think the pesticides have been catching up with them. And I think the populations of insects are down. But when I went and asked if we had a basic data on that, other than people like me noting that we don't see as many insects, there wasn't the basic data. We don't fund college students to go out and measure populations of insects that are common.
Mm. All right. Well.
And I think that that's a mistake in these days when we need ecological data so much. We live in a nice place, and let me know what happens with your further bad observations.
All right, maybe you'll call again on the next time you're here, Ward. Thanks, John. Let's go over to Dave in Olive Bridge.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener, and a lot to comment on. Actually, the lady with the carpenter, that's definitely carpenter bees. I did pest control many years ago. I'm very familiar with it. I have the same problem in my house.
Yeah.
My question is, for Years. I live in a unique area. It's a Vlie. It's a Vlie swamp, about 2,000 acres down from my property, mm-hmm. and very unique, like a boreal forest and tamarack peat bogs. I've been here for 20-some years, 30 years. I've never, until like 3 years ago, I go out in the early morning before it's dark in the winter, late winter, early spring, when it's still freezing, and I hear this noise, and I'd like to describe it to you.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know. I guessed something with either a mouse or, but it's still freezing, so it can't be an insect, but I don't know. And I went online, I researched, I look all over, I tried to get on your show before, but I'm going to describe it right now. There's two noises. One is like a, I can describe it as a creep, 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 creep. Then it goes peep, 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 up and down peeps. I cannot find anything online anywheres. And
what time of year is this?
So close with lights, flashlights, and I can't see anything. The only thing I can just think is maybe a field mouse, but I've never heard anything like this.
Okay.
Where is that located?
Olive Ridge, New York. It's about 18 miles west of Kingston in the Catskills, in the foothills of the Catskills.
Okay. And what month of the year were you hearing this sound?
It's always in very late winter, just as spring starts, but before really any thaws. It's actually still freezing.
And there's early a lot morning. Of wet, soft ground there, right? You said you had the American
the
tamarack
Vlie,
and
yes,
and a Vlie swamp, a couple thousand acres.
Yes, it's
take a look at the sounds for woodcock.
What's that?
For woodcock.
It doesn't sound that loud. Now, wouldn't woodcock be louder?
Well, in this, they do have a breeding dance. They fly up in the air,
uh-huh.
and something of your sound did make me think of that.
Now that's a bird. You're talking a little bird.
Yeah, it's not it's not exactly little, but
yeah.
it makes a sound like that. They fly up in the air and then they come down, almost
that's weird.
Like falling, and they. Were as they're coming down.
Oh, okay.
So I would take a look at that possibility. That's
yeah. Go ahead.
And the I'm interested in that as to what that is myself.
Okay.
And it's I'll go again. It's there's two sounds and it's coming from the same creature, whatever it is, and it's a and then it's I can only describe it as creep. Creep, 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 creep.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I blew my mind. I was like, I take the dog out early in the mornings, and I go with a flashlight, and I've looked and looked. I cannot see anything. I'm like, drive me crazy. I'm pushing the brush aside. And I didn't hear this years ago. I only heard it for the last 4 or 5 years, but I hear every year. In very early spring.
All right, well, Rich Guthrie will be back soon, and maybe you could try that sound on him, and if it's a bird, chances are he will know what it is. We only have about a minute left here. Eric in Catskill, you have about 30 seconds, and then Ward has 30 seconds to answer. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. In Brunswick, New York, about 18 years ago, I saw two mountain lions on a farm, a cow farm, cresting up over the hill. I put my gun up, you know, just to see, and the one had a collar. And at that point, I thought NCON released mountain lions. Is that possible?
No.
You're sure?
No.
Yeah.
I'm positive it was mountain lions. I'm positive it had I can't remember now if both had a collar, but one had a collar.
Would they have been tagged in some way? Could they have come from the west where they might have been tagged?
That's
possibly
what,
could have been tagged somewhere else.
That's after listening to your program today, that's what I was thinking.
Or maybe they were a pet.
I've heard that story that DEC let the mountain lions go. That story has been going around for 30 years or so. But there is no truth to it that they didn't decide that they were going to control the deer by releasing mountain lions and go and do it.
Okay.
Well, that would be outside of the law to do that.
All right. Well, Eric, we're out of time. Really? Thanks a lot for the call. Ward Stone, that went fast, didn't it?
Yeah, too fast. Let's do this more often.
All right, sir. Support comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services at a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. The New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, now offering legal help for veterans serving the public for over 30 years. NYSBA.org/lawyer referral. And Joseph's House and Shelter, Troy, New York, announcing its 31st Winter Walk for the Homeless and Love Thy Neighbor celebration, Saturday, December 6th, josephshousetroy.org for more information. Well, thanks again to Ward Stone. Thank you at home for listening, or wherever you are, in the car or just walking around. Thank you. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our control room engineer. Thanks to Mary Vetter for answering the phones, and our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday. I'm not sure what it is. I forgot. But Jessica said they're bringing a lot of food. That doesn't help you at home, but it helps us here quite a bit. So tune in.